Via remote, this is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. COVID-19 cases are surging here in the United States with more than 60,700 confirmed on Monday, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. Sharp increases in infections were confirmed in Illinois, Texas, Wisconsin, Tennessee, and California. The number of new infections has pushed several cities and states to a crisis point, including the southwest city of El Paso, Texas, where the number of coronavirus patients has reportedly tripled over the past 3 weeks. The situation has become so dire in the border city that officials have imposed a strict 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew and a two-week stay-at-home order. The new infections reported in the U.S. on Monday brings the total since February to more than 8.7 million. The highest total in the world, according to the Hopkins data. The U.S. also led the world in COVID-19 fatalities with more than 225,700. Worldwide, there are more than 43.6 million cases and more than 1.1 million deaths. Russia, France, Sweden, and Poland have also reported record numbers of infections in recent days. And a new study of the British population shows that antibodies in the human body fighting against COVID-19 declined rapidly in the British population during the summer, suggesting any immunity against the virus may not last long. Findings suggest the possibility of increasing the population immunity ahead of a second wave of infections in recent weeks that has forced the local lockdowns and restrictions. As always, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. Italy has approved a package of measures on Tuesday to support businesses hit by new restrictions aimed at reining in the coronavirus, hours after daily infections hit a new record high and COVID-19-related deaths jump. The measures will cost nearly $6.4 billion and include grants, tax breaks, and additional funds for temporary layoff schemes, this according to the Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. In an effort to curb the resurgent outbreak, Conte ordered bars and restaurants to close by 6 p.m. and shut down gyms, movie theaters, swimming pools, triggering protests against the closure in several cities. The lives of thousands of children under the age of five in war-torn Yemen are at risk because of acute malnutrition, this according to the United Nations Children's Fund. UN experts cautioned that actual numbers could be higher because the causes of malnutrition in Yemen have worsened this year. The improvements in the lives of Yemeni women and children have been reversed because of a combination of factors: escalating conflict, economic decline, coupled with the devastating impact of the COVID-19 pandemic that pushed an already exhausted population to the brink. Yemen has long been regarded as unsafe for children and women because of insufficient and poor quality diet, a high prevalence of communicable diseases, and elevated levels of food insecurity. More than 24 million Yemenis require some form of humanitarian assistance and protection. Hurricane Zeta brought strong winds, heavy rains to Mexico's Caribbean coast before weakening to a tropical storm Tuesday, now heading towards the United States. There were reports of deaths, or no reports of deaths, I should say, or significant damage after Zeta made landfall near the resort town of Tulum late Monday, the second hurricane to hit the Yucatan Peninsula this month. And the Greek Navy says one of its ships has collided with a container vessel near the Greek coast, injuring two crewmen, seriously damaging the Navy ship. Cargo ship, a much larger vessel registered to Portugal, was not damaged in that collision. Officials say all 27 crewmen on board the Greek minesweeper were rescued. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website. That is voanews.com. Also on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown. VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 28th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The people of Tanzania are voting today in presidential and parliamentary election.
Most people are scared that maybe this time around they face such kind of situation because the main opposition, Chadema, they have spoken outly that if the justice will not take its course, they won't accept the result.
Coronavirus takes a toll on Kenya's job market. Climate change in Africa threatens food security, health, and socioeconomic development. An eco-feminist movement calls for changes in the way business is done in Africa. And an ECOWAS UN delegation urges solution to Guinea's post-election crisis.
They ask the government to lift the blockade of Jalo, the residents. They ask opposition to go in front of the constitutional court if there are some problems about the results.
This morning, a discussion with a Liberian-born immigrant candidate in the 2020 U.S. election and a view from Zimbabwe on the U.S. election. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tanzanians are voting today Wednesday in presidential and parliamentary elections. Voting began somewhat peacefully Tuesday for security personnel on the autonomous island of Zanzibar, although there were reports of scrimmages between police and opposition supporters. The opposition has said that the election will not be free and fair. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an inclusive and peaceful electoral process. Neville Mina, Secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum, says although Tanzanians are generally peaceful people, there is a concern because the opposition has said it will accept nothing short of a victory.
There is a bit of panic because, like today in Zanzibar, what has happened, we have information indicating that there was some people who were shot by the police. I don't know what really happened, but they say that at least 7 people are dead because of the tension around the elections in Zanzibar. And you might be aware that elections in Zanzibar started on Tuesday because those the returning officers who are going to be supervising elections in the electoral polls, the police and the army, were supposed to vote on Tuesday so that they can take their position on Wednesday.
Mina, talking about Zanzibar, there were reports that the ACT Wazalendo presidential candidate had been arrested in Zanzibar. So how true is that?
Yes, there was a report that Sheikh Sharif Hamad was arrested, but later we were told that he was released with unconfirmed information. Says that he was grounded at his place in Zanzibar. He went to one of the police stations, was arrested there, and was kept under arrest on police custody. And then thereafter he was released, but he was told to go directly to his place. So I don't know actually later what really happened, but that was the report from Zanzibar.
So incumbent President Magufuli made his final plea or speech to the people of Tanzania on Tuesday. So what was his final message?
First of all, he has just concluded his campaigning stand because he didn't went to the rally, but it was an indoor meeting with the elders in Dodoma. And what he had told them, he just laid down the plans of the Christians if they be voted in for the coming 5 years. And he told that the election is going to be free and fair.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for a peaceful and inclusive election. Now, you talk already what's happening in the country, the mood of the country. How concerned are people about the transparency of the election and the possibility also of violence on election day?
As you may be aware, Tanzania is claimed to be a peaceful land, and people are not exposed to violence often. So most of people are scared that maybe this time around might face such kind of situation because the opposition, the main opposition, Chadema, they have spoken outly that if the justice will not take its course, they won't accept the result. And that's a bit alarming. And this time around, we have two counties, one in Zanzibar, Sheikh Sharif Hamad, and the Tundu Lissu as a presidential candidate in the Zimbabwe and Tanzania. These two people have a lot of supporters in both Tanzania. So we don't know what will happen, but I can see the police have said that the security will be very tight and they'll make sure that each and everything will be under control. But we can't predict actually what will happen. And as we are speaking now, in Tanzania, we have just seen the internet is so down, so some of the applications that cannot be easily accessed, like the data, WhatsApp, it's not easy to access right now. So maybe we don't know what really happened, but we are suspicious that maybe the communication authorities have just lowered the internet is so down. So in general, people are scared, but we hope for the best in the Wednesday that maybe things will be well organized and we hope for smoother elections.
Neville Mina, Secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum, was speaking with us from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. A delegation from the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the African Union, and the United Nations has called on both Guinean President Alpha Conde and opposition leader Selu Dalein Diallo to find a solution to the post-election crisis in the country. Between 21 and 27 people are said to have died during protests following the disputed October 18 presidential election. Mamadou Jean Bode is the editor of the Independent and Democrat newspapers in Guinea. He said the delegation has asked the government to lift the blockade around opposition leader Diallo's residence.
This Tuesday, many shops were opened and the people leave homes for seeking food. And they joined UN, African Union, ECOWAS mission, were in Conakry to find a way out of this electoral crisis. They met the government, the president, Alpha Conde, and Selu Dalein Diallo. They made a recommendation this Tuesday. They asked the government to lift the blockade of Diallo's residence, and they asked opposition to go in front of the constitutional court if there are some problems about the results.
How fair is the constitutional court?
Yeah. It's controlled by the government, and the opposition leader, Selu, says that he's not expecting much from this court, even though he will go there, but he said that he's not expecting much from this court. It will be like the Electoral Commission. According to Selu Dalein, all the institutions are controlled by the government, the president Alpha Conde in Guinea. It's why he asked his militant to defend his victory.
So, Mamadou, what can you tell us about the internet? Has it been restored?
Well, the internet has been restored today.
There have been reports of violence and people being killed in Guinea. Did the government address that?
Yeah, the government, the justice minister said yesterday that they will investigate and they will arrest all people who made that violence and they will judge them and jail them. That is the promise of the government.
Mamadou Diallo Balde is the editor of the Independent and Democrat newspapers of Guinea. He was speaking with us from the capital, Conakry. The Kenyan government says COVID-19 has forced nearly 2 million people out of work. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, many Kenyans who once had steady jobs before COVID-19 are now relying on informal work to survive.
32-year-old Paul Kenya is in his 10th job since March, when he lost his job as a school cook before schools closed due to COVID-19. Kenya is now helping to build a rented house in Nairobi as a construction laborer. He says one only does these construction jobs when you have got nothing else to do, and construction jobs can stop at any time, says Kenya. My previous job was good, he adds. For now, the father of two makes $10 a day, barely enough to get by. 30-year-old Silas Ngondu lost his job as a waiter when the government restricted restaurants to fight the spread of the virus. He's since been working as a day laborer installing doors. Ngondu says this is a job that pays daily, and you can come tomorrow and be told there's no work, and you should come the next day. He says this is not a permanent job. If I come late, says Ngondu, they give someone else a job and you have to try your luck the next day. The Kenya Bureau of Statistics reports more than 1.7 million people lost their full-time employment between April and June alone. Employers say businesses and suppliers have been hit hard. Nairobi grocery store manager Eda Chepkoech says people are buying less.
It has affected our sales, our daily business. Huh? Before, we used to get a lot of money, we used to get a lot of customers, but now business has gone down.
The Federation of Kenya Employers, which represents about 1,900 companies, says the pandemic has erased a big portion of private sector job gains that had been made in recent years. Jacqueline Mugo is the Federation's chief executive officer.
We then looked at the number of jobs that had been created in the formal economy. We're not talking informal, we're just looking at the formal sector. Since 2015, and the figure that we have, these are national figures, are 218,800 jobs created in the period 2015 to date. So if out of the 218,800 jobs, 173,743 jobs had been lost, it means that 80% of the jobs created in the last 5 years in the formal sector had been wiped out by COVID-19 in the last 5 months.
Mugo warns at least another 1 million jobs are at risk in coming months if the economy does not soon recover. But a further easing of restrictions needed to jumpstart the economy may not come soon enough. Kenya saw a jump in daily COVID-19 cases after it eased controls on movement in late September. The East African nation has since March confirmed about 50,000 infections and over 900 deaths. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Patti in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 28. Activists of an eco-feminist movement throughout Africa are increasingly calling for change in the way business is done on the continent. Ruth Nyambura, a leader of the movement in Kenya, spoke to Ricky Shryak about what they are working for and how the struggle is progressing.
Feminist political ecology is concerned with how gender and gender relations as a whole interact with other systems of power, systems of power to basically structure access to resources in the diversity, whether it's, you know, access to food, access to water, access to land. It thinks about the politics of labor, for example, on this continent. African women farmers produce majority of the food that we eat. They still have very little access to land, or in the ways in which they have access to land is largely mediated by a male figure. And also because of neoliberal globalization and the afterlife of colonial policies and dispossession from their land, it means that they have less and less of land to be able to thrive, to be able to farm, to be able to pass down to their the younger generation.
Is it difficult to go about changing things when the issue is that the structure itself is the problem? You know, it's hard to address the problem when the rules of the game are the problem in the first place.
Absolutely. You know, the very first thing I must say is that even just to dare to imagine a different world, right, that in itself is such a struggle, because the language of capitalism, the language of liberalization, the language of patriarchy, the language of different forms, you know, other related forms of marginalization of oppression, the first thing they do is that they limit our language of liberation. They tell us, this is how you can dream, or this is how you should not be dreaming, right? So that is actually the very first struggle. And so much history around our resistance, around our culture, as I was saying, that, for example, women's seeds, the knowledge around seed saving, right? And they see that are so resilient to the climate crisis, which the continent is facing disproportionately, obviously, right? This is knowledge that's passed down, you know. And once people are put in a space where they are, where the things become illegal, you're also limiting the visions of liberation.
Do you think that this is a growing movement?
There, I'll say this, there has always been resistance. Always been resistance. Wherever there's oppression, there's always resistance. It doesn't matter whether it's not documented on social media, because the other thing also that I really must say is that social media has done a really fantastic job over the last decade, for example.
That was Ruth Nyambura, a Kenyan activist. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Nairobi. The World Meteorological Organization is calling for urgent action to mitigate the impact of climate change in Africa, which threatens food security, health, and socio-economic development on the continent. The WMO has just launched a multi-agency publication, The State of the Climate in Africa 2019. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report presents a bleak snapshot of current and future climate trends in Africa brought on by an inexorable rise in warming. Since 1901, it notes Africa has warmed by more than 1 degree Celsius, with 2019 among the three warmest years on record. The World Meteorological Organization warns Africa faces many challenges brought on by climate variability, extreme weather events, and sea level rise. A case in point is Tropical Cyclone Idai, which struck Mozambique in 2019. Idai, one of the most destructive tropical cyclones ever recorded in the Southern Hemisphere, caused more than 700 deaths, widespread loss of homes, livelihoods, and displacement. The Food and Agriculture Organization reports the number of undernourished people in drought-prone sub-Saharan African countries has increased by 45.6% since 2012. WMO Director of Regional Strategic Office, Felipe Lucio, tells VOA many people are likely to go hungry as a result of climate variability and change.
With increased warming, we expect a reduction in terms of food production. We also expect impacts in terms of disease and pests. But importantly, we will have impacts generated by flooding on the infrastructure system for agriculture production, which is the main source of livelihoods and food security in the continent.
The report notes new diseases are emerging in regions where they had not been seen before because of rising temperatures and changes in rainfall patterns. For example, malaria epidemics have occurred in the higher altitudes of East African highlands, where mosquitoes previously were unable to survive. The economic impact on the continent is also great. WMO climate coordinator Omar Badour says the gross domestic product in five African sub-regions is expected to decrease by 2.25% to 12.12% as a result of global temperature increase.
It leads to a jobless situation and less economic activity, employment and immigration and so conflicts. So it's really an alarming indicator that we can see as an impact on the African continent.
WMO urges African governments to increase their climate risk management strategies. These involve improving preparedness, prevention, and early warning systems based on good data and weather forecasting. It says Africa should employ techniques such as efficient and clean energy sources. It says solar-powered, efficient micro-irrigation, for example, improves agricultural yields by up to 300% and reduces water usage by up to 90%, this while offsetting carbon emissions. WMO says these techniques have been shown to increase farm-level incomes by 5 to 10 times where they've been employed. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Next Tuesday, November 3rd, Americans will cast the final ballots for president and vice president and also national and local legislators. This morning, we continue our conversation with some of the many candidates with ties to Africa who are running for various elected positions locally around the United States. This morning, we are talking with Nequita Ricks, who is running for state representative for Colorado District No. 40. Her family immigrated to the United States in 1980 following Liberia's violent military coup led by Samuel Doe. Ms. Ricks says she's running for elected office because she wants to make the American dream achievable for others.
I'm running because there are so many things that America has offered us. I've had the opportunity to go to school, get married, to raise my family. But I also know that this dream is not as accessible for others. And I want to ensure that people like me, whether you're a first-generation immigrant like myself, or someone who's been here for five generations, that American dream is still achievable for all. I look at what's going on. There's so many inequities within our system. Many voices are not being heard at the state capitol, whether you are an essential worker or someone who works at a grocery store, or even the small business owner that works for more than 60 hours a week in their small business trying to make it work. I'm running to represent all of the voices within District 40 and the people like immigrants like myself.
What's the makeup of your district?
We have about 80,000 people. About 9% are African American, 17% are Latino, and about 52% are white. I come from a very highly diverse place in Colorado. The city has over 160 different languages that are spoken in the public schools. And so you would find that one out of every five persons would tell you that they are from another country.
You know, Nequita, one can say that you are one of the shining examples of people who have come to this country, the United States, and have achieved their American dream. So what would be your message, say, to people in Africa, Liberia in particular, about how you have managed to achieve this American dream to be running for Colorado State House of Representatives?
I would say that no matter where we come from, I think that America does offer the opportunity if you work hard, you play by the rules, and you're willing to engage. This is a land of opportunity. And that opportunity, even though it seems like it's fleeting, is still one of the best countries in the world that can embrace you. You know, I've been fortunate to come here, even though we came out of war. Aurora, the city, opened its doors to us, and it became home for us.
Can you speak to, say, a young woman in, say, Africa, and who might one day want to be in your position, not necessarily in the United States, running for a position in the United States, but just doing something in Africa? What encouragement can you give them?
To every young woman out there, whatever your dream is, no matter what it is, I didn't just run and win. I've run two other times before. So this is my third run. And what I would say to you is never give up. If you set your mind on a goal, if you first don't succeed, you know, go back, dust yourself off, get more education in it, get more training, get more advice, and get back at it again.
Nequita Ricks, it's so nice to talk with you, and I wish you the best in your campaign.
Thank you so much, James. I appreciate you so much.
Nequita Ricks is a Liberian-born immigrant candidate who is running for state representative in Colorado. She was speaking with us from Aurora, Colorado. Final voting in the U.S. election is next Tuesday, November 3rd. We have been speaking to people around the world about whether they think the election matters to them and to their countries. Today, we hear from Zimbabwe.
U.S. presidential election does not matter to Zimbabwe. It does not matter because history has showed us that it does not matter who is in the White House. Sanctions will still exist, sanctions against Zimbabwe. We already have a strained relationship with the U.S., and I don't see it getting fixed anytime soon.
The United States of America elections, like any other elections in the world, are of a keen interest to all Zimbabweans. Remember, Zimbabwe is now porous to all borders, especially at a time where internally we felt united as a people. We are all relying on international players to help us negotiate our way out of economic problems, our way out of our political problems, our way out of our social problems.
The views of some Zimbabweans about the 2020 U.S. election. We have more comments from around the world about the U.S. vote tomorrow. And that's it for this Wednesday, October 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great day.